Welcome to Circulation on the Run, your weekly podcast summary and backstage pass to the journal and its editors. I'm Dr. Carolyn Lam, Associate Editor from the National Heart Center and Duke National University of Singapore.
And I'm Dr. Greg Hundley, Associate Editor, Director of the Pauley Heart Center at VCU Health in Richmond, Virginia. Carolyn, when is the best time to check your blood pressure if you have a home monitoring device? Morning? Afternoon? Nighttime? And what do those nighttime fluctuations infer? Well, we'll hear a lot more in our feature discussion today. But first, let's grab a cup of coffee and jump into some of the other papers in the issue. I'm going to start first this week. And my first paper comes from Dr. Joe Wu at Stanford University. Carolyn, a quiz. Are all endothelial cells alike?
Jeez, Greg. Okay, I'm going to hedge. I bet a lot of them share similarities, but there may be some differences.
Yes, Carolyn. Dr. Wu and his associates perform a series of elegant experiments involving mice, and they found that certain tissue-specific endothelial cells cluster strongly by tissue, like those in the liver or the brain, whereas others from, for example, adipose tissue or the heart, have considerable transcriptomic overlap with endothelial cells from other tissues. They identified novel markers of tissue-specific endothelial cells and signaling pathways that may be involved in maintaining their identity, and sex was a considerable source of heterogeneity in the endothelial transcriptome. In addition, they found that markers of heart and lung endothelial cells in mice were conserved in human fetal heart and lung endothelial cells and identified potential angiocrine interactions between tissue-specific endothelial cells and other cell types by analyzing ligand and receptor expression patterns.
So interesting, Greg. You especially had me at sex differences. So what's the take-home message?
Right, Carolyn. So this group discovered a series of transcriptional networks that maintain endothelial cell heterogeneity, and that angiocrine and functional relationships exist between tissue-specific endothelial cells. These findings open the door for future studies that can manipulate these pathways and perhaps modify processes like atherosclerosis that impact the endothelium.
Wow, that's cool, Greg. Well, from your paper, I'm going to a mechanistic paper too. And the next study really aimed to define cardiac fibroblast heterogeneity during ventricular remodeling, as well as the underlying mechanisms that regulate their function. So important questions here. And co-corresponding authors, Drs. Prosper and Lara Estiaso from Clínica Universidad de Navarra in Pamplona and Spain, as well as Dr. Lindner from Maine Medical Center Research Institute in Scarborough, Maine in the U.S., and their co-authors basically characterized cardiac fibroblasts after myocardial infarction using a whole host of very novel techniques like single-cell and bulk RNA sequencing, ATEC sequencing, and functional assays. Swine and patient samples were studied using bulk RNA sequencing.
Very intriguing. What did they find?
They identified and characterized a unique cardiac fibroblast subpopulation that emerged after myocardial infarction in mice. These activated fibroblasts exhibited a clear profibrotic signature, expressing high levels of collagen triple helix repeat containing 1 and localized into the scar. Moreover, the absence of this regulator resulted in pronounced lethality due to ventricular rupture. Finally, a population of cardiac fibroblasts with a similar transcriptome was identified in a swine model of myocardial infarction, as well as in heart tissues from patients with myocardial infarction and dilated cardiomyopathy.
Ah, so important information on how fibroblasts start the scar formation after infarction. So, Carolyn, what's the take-home message here for this research?
Well, this paper really provides important information on cardiac fibroblast heterogeneity, their dynamics during the course of myocardial infarction, and the authors also redefine the cardiac fibroblasts that respond to cardiac injury and participate in myocardial remodeling. This study identifies collagen triple helix repeat containing 1 as a novel regulator of the healing scar process and as a target for future translational studies.
Great, Carolyn. You're doing such a great job. This is an issue for Double Quiz. Have you ever heard of treatments for hypertension incorporating Chinese herbal formula Gastrodia Uncaria granules?
What? Are you trying to speak Chinese, Greg?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure you're going to tell us about it.
Right. So this study is from Professor Yan Li from Ruijin Hospital and Shanghai Jiangtong University School of Medicine. Gastrodia Uncaria granules, Carolyn, is a mixture of Chinese herbs that dates back many years, I think thousands, and in this study was used in patients with masked hypertension. So in the study, patients with an office blood pressure of less than 140 over 90 millimeters of mercury, but a daytime ambulatory blood pressure of 135 to 150 millimeters of mercury systolic, or 85 to 95 millimeters of mercury diastolic, were randomized 1-to-1 to receive the treatment of, and I'm going to abbreviate it, GUG, versus placebo, 5 to 10 grams, twice daily for 4 weeks. The primary efficacy variable was the change in daytime ambulatory blood pressure.
Ah, so did it work?
Well, in their intention to treat analysis, daytime systolic diastolic blood pressure was reduced by 5 and 3 millimeters of mercury in the GUG group and 3 and 1.6 millimeters of mercury in the placebo group, respectively. The between group difference in blood pressure reductions was significant. 2.5 and 1.7 millimeters of mercury, and 24-hour blood pressure by 2 and 1.5 millimeters of mercury, but not for the clinic and nighttime blood pressures. The per-protocol analysis in 229 patients produced similar results. Only one adverse event, sleepiness during the day, was reported, and no serious adverse events occurred. So, Carolyn, a potentially inexpensive regimen found useful in China for patients with masked hypertension. To learn more of the results of this interesting study, listeners are suggested to review the article in this particular issue.
Wow, interesting, Greg. Okay, so from hypertension to CABG. Now, we know that approximately 15% of saphenous vein grafts occlude during the first year after coronary artery bypass graft surgery, or CABG, despite aspirin use. So, can ticagrelor added to standard aspirin improve saphenous venous graft patency at 1 year after CABG? Now, this is the question that Dr. Stenberg from St. Antonius Hospital from Nieuwegein in Netherlands and colleagues sought to answer in the popular CABG trial, which was an investigator-initiated, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled, multicenter trial of 499 patients with one or more saphenous vein grafts who were randomly assigned after CABG to ticagrelor or placebo added to standard aspirin. The primary outcome was saphenous vein graft occlusion at 1 year assessed with coronary CT angiography occurred in 10.5% of the ticagrelor group versus 9.1% in the placebo group. So that's an odds ratio of 1.29, and it was not significant. The secondary outcome of 1 year saphenous vein graft failure, which was a composite of vein graft occlusion, revascularization, myocardial infarction in the myocardial territory supplied by the vein graft, or sudden death, well, that occurred in 14.2% of patients in the ticagrelor group versus 11.6% in patients in the placebo group. Again, not a significant difference.
So, Carolyn, a negative study? What's our take home here?
In this randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial, the addition of ticagrelor to standard aspirin after CABG did not reduce the rate of saphenous vein graft occlusions at 1 year. Now, this conclusion differs from some other studies that investigated this research question, and this is discussed in this editorial that you got to pick up. It's by Dr. Goldman from University of Arizona.
Wow, Carolyn, great job. Well, we've got a couple more articles in this issue, and I'll start by describing a research letter by Dr. Davier regarding heparin-induced thrombocytopenia and COVID-19. And then, Carolyn, there's a second research letter from our own Torbjørn Åmland regarding established cardiovascular biomarkers provide limited prognostic information in unselected patients hospitalized with COVID-19. And then finally, from Dr. Chongyang Alberts, a case series entitled The Enemy Within, Sudden Onset of Reversible Cardiogenic Shock with Biopsy-Proven Cardiomyocyte Infection by SARS-CoV-2.
We've also got an ECG challenge by Dr. Srinivasan entitled A Red Flag ECG, also known as, and have you heard of this, South African Flag Pattern. Okay, here's a hint. It's an important but subtle ischemic ECG change. You gotta look it up. There's an On My Mind paper by Dr. Alexander on at risk of depriving patients life-saving cardiac surgery. And those are the implications of the ischemia trial for CABG. A research letter by Dr. Susan entitled Endotheliopathy is Induced by Plasma from Critically Ill Patients and Associated with Organ Failure in Severe COVID-19. And finally, in cardiology news, Tracy Hampton reviews the most recent literature in top journals like Nature Metabolism, Cell, Stem Cell, and Circulation Research. Wow, Bonanza issue, so cool. But I really want to hear about the different blood pressure patterns now. Let's go to our feature discussion, shall we?
Absolutely, here we go. Well, listeners, we are excited to get to this feature discussion to learn more about the use of ambulatory blood pressure measures, particularly those that are collected 24 hours and during the nighttime. We have with us Dr. Kazumi Kario from the Jishi Medical University in Japan, and our own associate editor, Dr. Wanpen Vong Bentassen from University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. Welcome to you both. And Kazumi, could you start us off, please, and just describe some of the background that led you to perform this study, and what hypothesis did you want to address?
The old guidelines management of the hypertension are now recommend, instead of the office blood pressure, now the 24 blood pressure management. So for example, the ABPM and also home blood pressure monitoring. But the theoretically, the 24 blood pressure reduction is very much important, absolute values. But also our hypothesis is not only 24 blood pressure quantity reduction, but also we should normalize circadian rhythm. Usually blood pressure reduced by 10 to 20% at night during the sleep compared to the daytime. But the subgroup exhibited non-dip bars and also the LIDAR higher at night during the nighttime sleep period compared to the daytime. And also on blood pressure variability, the surge blood pressure in the morning. So circadian rhythm normalization and also adequate blood pressure variability, especially in morning surge, is important for the quality control of the for the hypertension management. So my hypothesis is that blood pressure reduction, the out-of-office blood pressure, and the normalized circadian rhythm, and then the adequate, to keep adequate morning surge. So all the three components identified optimal 24 blood pressure control. So I want to confirm our hypothesis that optimized 24 blood pressure control consists of the three components, 24 blood pressure reduction, and the normalized the circadian rhythm, and the keeping the adequate surge, it should be idea of the cardiovascular prevention or not. That's my hypothesis and background.
So with our 24-hour ambulatory monitoring, evaluating in this study, do we have the normal dip during the evening? Do we have a rise associated with the circadian rhythm? What is the variability of the blood pressure over time? Tell us what study population and how did you design this study to address your hypothesis?
This population is the hypertensive patient, 90% or more, and the outpatient who keep the adequate, the active daily living, and they were medicated. So usually conventional antihypertensive medication is the effective to reducing the office blood pressure and daytime. But the antihypertensive treatment may not be sustained to the reducing the nocturnal blood pressure and next morning before taking pills. So it may be the peak toll of the nighttime blood pressure and the morning blood pressure. So our hypothesis target is an already medicated hypertensive patient. So we should find out the pitfall of the current hypertensive treatment. It should be the nighttime and next morning.
So we're addressing whether the efficacy of our antihypertensive medications are maintaining low blood pressures at night and avoiding a surreptitious rise in blood pressure when we wake up. So how many patients did you enroll and what were your study results?
Our study population number is 6,359 patients were enrolled. And then find out compared to the daytime also was a risk, but the nighttime blood pressure average was a more the precise risk predictor of cardiovascular events. So cardiovascular events consist of the atherosclerotic cardiovascular events, consist of the stroke and coronary artery disease. And also this nighttime blood pressure was associated with the risk of the heart failure. And then very interestingly, disrupted circadian rhythm, it rises at night higher during the nighttime compared to the daytime. It was an independent risk for the cardiovascular event, especially for the heart failure. So even after controlling for the daytime, even under nighttime blood pressure, this pattern, nighttime riser, was an independent risk. So very interesting results.
So elevations of systolic blood pressure during nighttime, during sleep, were associated with future atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease as well as heart failure. And one more quick point. Was there a particular magnitude of rise of that systolic blood pressure at night that was important? And did you find similar results for men and for women?
Similar results for men and women. And then the average was increased, almost the higher during the nighttime. So average of the rising pattern was 10% around during the nighttime compared to the daytime.
So even a 10% increase in systolic blood pressure at night relative to daytime was important for forecasting these adverse cardiovascular events. So Juan Pin, can you help us take these results from this elegant ambulatory monitoring study and put those in the context of other study results that have evaluated 24 ambulatory monitoring of blood pressure?
I think the notion of nighttime blood pressure as an independent predictor of cardiovascular outcome has been shown in other cohort, but usually not this large magnitude. That is an international registry, IDECO, that in different countries around the world that have demonstrated this. But again, like I said, it compiled from a smaller data set. There's even fewer data sets in the United States. There's a cohort from Jackson Heart, but again, it's less than 1,000. And most of other cohort have looked at mostly a target organ level, not at the heart CV outcome. So I think this adds to an important observation. And I think that the result from the nighttime, it's similar, but extended from previously that look at individual outcome using an adjudicated data committee that also a very distinctive feature of the study that is a committee that look at this and look at a specific outcome rather than just a retrospective using the death index from different countries. The other part that's slightly different perhaps, and I learned from reading it, is the extreme dipping that those who drop a lot. Initially, people think that it might be associated with adverse outcome, but even to me, I wasn't sure what this means. But in this study, demonstrated extreme dipper, maybe not as much, that shouldn't be worried as much compared to the actual nighttime blood pressure itself or non-dipping itself.
Kazumi, what do you see as the next study that needs to be performed in this area of research?
Oh, it's an observational study of the on the current medical situation. So next step is we should focus on the nighttime blood pressure, regardless of the office and the daytime. So even they are controlled, if we should target the nighttime blood pressure and successfully controlled, the organ damage may be decreased and the subsequent the cardiovascular event should be decreased. So for international study targeting the nighttime blood pressure is the next topic.
And Juan Pen, do you have anything to add to that?
I'd like to see more large observational study from the US with diverse population because the salt consumption in Asia, particularly in Japan, it's probably among the highest. So perhaps the nighttime blood pressure, it's confounded by high sodium consumption. We're not too far behind, obviously, but it'd be nice to know what it means in the U.S. And obviously, they're targeting nighttime blood pressure is the hot topic, and that's by itself is probably another 30 minutes an hour of discussion, but I think that that's a very important area of research.
Well, listeners, what a really wonderful discussion. And in this study from Japan of over 6,000 individuals treated for high blood pressure, those with 24-hour monitoring and exhibiting a rise in systolic blood pressure during the nighttime was associated with future cardiovascular events and an increase in the risk of heart failure. Moving forward from these experts, performing additional observational studies to confirm these findings in other populations, and perhaps a randomized trial trying to target therapeutic interventions that would lower nighttime blood pressure may be warranted. Thank you, Dr. Cario and Dr. Vong Pentassen. We wish you a great week, and we look forward to catching you on the run next week. This program is copyright the American Heart Association 2020.